Pippa Hudson. Lines are always open on 021 446 0567.
Now, as I mentioned in the intro to the show, it's 30 years today since the loss of the Helderberg aircraft, and we are devoting the remainder of this half hour to that story. Just to recap some of the basic facts for you, it's SAA Flight 295. It took off from Taipei's Chiang Kai-shek International Airport and was en route to South Africa when a fire broke out in the cargo hold. We know that the pilot, Captain Davi Ace, called in to declare an emergency, asked for permission to divert to the nearest airport. We don't really know for certain what happened next. We do know that the plane subsequently crashed into the Indian Ocean off the coast of Mauritius, and that all 159 people on board were lost. Now, in the ensuing three decades, there have been numerous attempts to try and get to the truth. There was the Margo Commission of Inquiry in the 1980s. There was a further probe by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, none of them arriving at a definitive answer. And speculation has long abounded of a cover-up and the fact that the plane might have been carrying some kind of illegal cargo, whether it was ammunition or rocket fuel components, both of them, of course, under arms embargo at that time due to the political situation in South Africa. Delighted to be joined in studio today by Dr. David Klatsov, forensic investigator with very close working knowledge of this story. And in a little while, we'll hear from a family member of one of the Helderberg victims who is fighting to reopen the probe. But first, David, great to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Pippa, and hello to all your listeners.
How did you first become involved with this case?
I was originally approached by Boeing to look at one aspect of the crash, namely the carbon monoxide levels in the bodies that were recovered. Thereafter, I was approached by the Saturday Star to represent them and to assist them in an investigation into the whole issue in front of the press council. Mm-hmm. And that's where my detailed investigation of the Helderberg really started nearly 30 years ago.
Okay. Now, of course, the crash site itself was far out at sea. We're talking very, very deep water here. How much physical evidence was available for you to look at?
Well, I didn't look at the physical evidence. Yeah. What I did was I got hold of all the role players, and I pieced together what they had to tell me. And from that set of role players and from the transcript of the Margo inquiry, mm-hmm. it became quite obvious that Margo was part of the cover-up. And if one reads the Margo inquiry, which I think very few people have, you'll see that Margo leaves footprints of his cover-up in the inquiry. And it becomes quite obvious, and there is only one explanation of why Margo tried to ban the reading, for instance, of certain parts of the cockpit voice recorder. Now, the reason that Margo wanted to do that was that it indicated categorically that the fire occurred at a time when dinner was being served. And we know that dinner is served on those flights and on most international flights within about 2 hours of takeoff, 2 to 3 hours. They serve the drinks trolley first, and then dinner is served. And we could hear the discussion of dinner in the cockpit. The cockpit crew are served from the first class galley at the same time as the first class passengers. And immediately after the discussion about dinner, we hear the fire alarm go, and we know that there was a fire at that stage. So there was a fire 2 hours before, 3 hours before, maybe. Mm. But normally what you do, the standard thing to do, is if you have a fire on board, land that aircraft and see that there's not irreparable damage which could compromise you for the rest of the flight. Mm. And we know from the fact that Ace radioed back to the radio station, which was called ZUR, we know that he radioed back, and we know that he asked for permission to land. And I have that from at least four different affidavited sources. Mm-hmm. We know that that tape mysteriously went missing. This is the history of the Helderberg. Yeah. But it never went missing. It was taken out and given to Gert van der Veer, who was the CEO of SAA at the time. And van der Veer would not deny at the TRC when I cross-examined him. He did not deny that he'd received that tape, and he couldn't explain to me what had happened to it. I think it still exists, and I think van der Veer knows. And van der Veer has consistently lied for the last 30 years. And he needs to come out before he dies and tell the truth about what happened.
Now, that echoes very closely the message I heard from Peter Otson yesterday when I spoke to him by phone to Australia. Peter is the son of a man who lost his life on the Helderberg. In fact, just days before Peter's birth, his father was lost in that crash. And he has spent his entire adult life fighting to get this investigation reopened and has, like David, been on a quest, an ongoing quest, to find more information, to interview people who were involved with SAA at the time, and to find out what happened. Let's just listen to a portion of that interview, speaking to me from Australia yesterday about his ongoing efforts. Peter, you lost your father in the Helderberg crash, or more accurately, you lost the opportunity to ever know your father because you were still 10 days away from being born when that crane came down. Obviously, it's something that must have had a profound impact on your life and your mother's life. And I know in adulthood, you've really made this something of a personal crusade to try and get to the truth of what happened in that crash. You're now a qualified legal professional. You've been trying for several years now to get an inquiry reopened into the disaster. When I last heard about you 5 years ago, you'd written to the president asking for him to appoint a new commission. What response did you receive, if any?
Pippa, I think that the president's hands have been busy in other directions since we wrote to him. There's been no response to any of our letters, unfortunately. And so that Commission of Inquiry is still, unfortunately, a not-realized dream.
I know you haven't given up. You haven't sat back waiting for the president to take it into his hands. Has there been any consideration of going to court to try and force his hand?
Pippa, there have been a number of steps that we've taken. We've done a substantial amount of research, and we've conducted some very interesting interviews with some people who knew a great deal at the time. At this point in time, I think it's largely a case of just gathering as much evidence as possible so that when we do go to court, it's a matter of putting the best case possible forwards for a commission of inquiry to be opened.
Okay, so you haven't given up the thought of having a commission. I mean, why is it so important to you, Peter? After all these years, we've had the Margo Commission, which found no clarity. We've had the TRC, which didn't shed any more light on what happened. With every day that passes, it's further and further away from the crash itself. More people involved have passed away. Do you think there is any point 30 years down the line? Do you have any hope that you will ever get answers?
The apartheid government was responsible for a vast number of atrocities, and I think we're only starting to scratch the surface of what was done in those days. We've had the Timor inquiry recently, which really did show how shockingly well these events were covered up and how destructive it can be to so many families to have these apartheid mysteries remain mysteries for so many years. We've done a whole lot of interviews of people who knew a great deal at the time. We've met with a gentleman called Willy Bortma, who gave us a statement who showed that he had previously seen arms and ammunition loaded onto commercial planes. He confirmed that he was instructed by the South African Airways CEO at the time to seize the manifest of the airplane and to make sure no one could see it. We've met with an Australian gentleman, Alan Dexter, who confirmed that the senior SAA management in Taiwan was aware that there was illegal armaments for the Helderberg and that was meant to be a massive secret. And those SAA seniors were incredibly surprised when this man said, "But I knew about them." So there is definitely a smoking gun, and there is definitely a need to find out what happened. We've had a couple of very interesting additional pieces of information come through. Some time ago, I met with some researchers, and researchers had done a lot of trawling through old archives and databases, and they found documents which are incredibly interesting, documents which show that arms were being carried on the airplane, documents which haven't been put before the various commissions of inquiry. And startlingly enough, I very recently met with a gentleman who was an advisor to Minister Stella Sigcau. And the minister was asked a parliamentary question by the opposition at the time. And she said to her advisor, "Find out more. I need to reply to this question." And the advisor went off and spoke to the National Intelligence Services and was briefed by the National Intelligence Agency, And the content of the briefing largely was that the plane was brought down by illegal armaments. And he reported back to the minister, and the minister then went back to the National Assembly and gave her answer, and the answer was completely false and didn't include any of those allegations which had been raised by the NIA.
I mean, Peter, that's staggering, the suggestion there, because, I mean, I can understand why members of the former apartheid government would want to keep on actively working against you, working against a reopening of the inquiry, working to suppress evidence. But to hear that a member of the current, or at least the post-94 era, would be complicit in what you've suggested there, would be complicit in suppressing information. Why do you think it would be so?
Well, Pippa, the SAA brand has been very close to this government's heart, and we're not entirely sure why. I think more and more we're starting to see some funny links between government and SAA. At the time that the plane went down, it was insured for a phenomenal amount of money through, I believe it was Lloyd's of London. The insurance company obviously paid out, and the SAA and the government reaped the rewards of that. If SAA or the government had to repay that money today, it would be a huge amount. It would be more than SAA is currently worth, because we're talking 30 years of interest plus the repayment of the plane itself.
David Klatzoff, listening into that interview, do you agree with Peter's theory?
Absolutely. Peter and I have worked very closely on this together, and there's no question about it that it would bring down SAA if this thing became a new inquiry which found the truth, as we have put before the public on so many occasions. And it, despite the fact that 30 years have gone, the fact that there's fraud would mean that this could be reopened and prescription wouldn't apply until that started all over again. It would run for 3 years from that date when we established, or when we could get a court order to establish that there was, in fact, skullduggery. But this every single piece of information that we've uncovered over 30 years has pointed in the direction of illegal armaments. Every single piece of information has pointed to the fact that they suppressed information that was unsuitable to their purpose. And when you say the ANC government, why would they want to do it? They have every reason to collude, because they want SAA to survive. And secondly, I think that there was an agreement made between the ANC government and the Nationalists that we won't go too deeply into your ugly secrets if you don't go too deeply into ours. And there is no honor amongst politicians whatsoever.
No, we don't. We unfortunately know that all too well. Yeah. If you've joined us late to the conversation, my guest in studio is Dr. David Klatzoff, speaking to us about the investigation into what happened to the Helderberg. It's 30 years today since the flight crashed into the ocean with 159 people on board. And you were hearing earlier from the son of a man who was on board that plane. Peter Ottson never had the opportunity to meet his father because he was born 10 days after the Helderberg came down, but remains determined to see the inquiry reopened. Now, listening into that conversation, Martin Veltz has given us a call, editor of Newsweek. Martin, good afternoon, and thanks for ringing in.
Yes, we're all gathering our bits of history here, but an unbelievable one. I was a reporter for the Sunday newspaper Report at the time, and I was sent 2 weeks from today, 30 years ago, to Taipei to investigate what had actually happened there. And on the plane, I met a South African trader who was actually on his way to replace a cargo of goods that he was importing that went down with the plane. And he informed me that South African Airways had very carefully organized to have only four small clearing agents handle all cargo for South African Airways. So major international companies were excluded, which means the South African Airways already knew they had to have control of cargo manifests. And the only way they could do that was by having small clearing agents they favored and that they could control. I knew them, went looking for the four. The first one I found, I telephoned from my hotel in Taipei, and the man said, yes, absolutely, he had some very important things to tell me, but he was only prepared to do this face-to-face. And the arrangement was that we would meet the following day. The next morning, I phoned his office and asked the receptionist to speak to him, at which stage she burst into tears and informed me that he'd been run down and killed in the street earlier in the morning. that was a sort of a, where it could be pure chance, but it set the tone, because the next one I went to said absolutely there could be nothing wrong with what was on the plane. You know, they sucked the IATA rules. They knew it was a passenger plane and all sorts of hot goods were excluded from the cargo. I said, well, I'd like to see the IATA rules. Can I come and see him? I went there to discover that their copy of the IATA rules was on a high shelf covered in dust, hadn't looked, been looked at for years and had most of its pages missing. So there was no reference to IATA rules. And the second thing was, all the manifests. I said, well, what, where are the cargo manifests? No, no, we sent them all back to our clients on the Saturday afternoon. I said, why? No, we always do that. So all the manifests up to were fakes. They were all produced on the Monday and Tuesday after the air crash.
Sure.
The entire operation was a cover-up. I was then told, okay, they didn't check the outer rules, but Taipei Airport was, it was a military dictatorship, you know, and they checked everything that went through there. So I phoned the general who was in charge of the cargo yards, and he said, absolute nonsense. He says, it's absolutely impractical. All we do is we keep the cargo in these warehouses for 3 days in case there's a bomb on it to go off it on a ticking clock. And he says, you know, 1 in 10 things we actually open up to look at or whatever, sampling. So he says, no question that we can certify one way or the other.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and we tried to find Mr. Ace, who was in the only South African Airways representative there at the time. He spent the entire week avoiding me. He didn't go anywhere near his office for the whole week.
Hmm.
It was very hot and ugly from minute one. The only other thing I can really add was, informally, I was told that the material that was being shipped, which added to the political complexity, was that it had somehow been procured from a United States air base in the Pacific. America, Crocker,
Secretary of State at the time, wasn't he?
Yes. Definitely favored South Africa's military operations against what the United States saw as communist forces in Africa. And we must keep in mind that apartheid South Africa was at war, had been at war for 10 years or more with all the neighboring states. I mean, there was a war in Angola. There was a war in Zimbabwe. There was a war in Mozambique. We were surrounded by, you know, a sort of a secret war, supposedly secret war. And our allies were America, but which could not be seen as an ally, and equally significant, Israel, was helping us procure illicit arms, because while they were buying it for themselves, they were helping buy it for us, and we were helping to pay. South Africa was a funding source. That's fairly well historically documented now. Why I mention that is the Margot Commission was an absolute farce. Cecil Margot, whom I knew, having been a lawyer in my previous life, was an honorary officer of both the Israeli military forces and the South African Air Force, both. So he had a tremendous loyalty to these major allies. Whatever came in military materials on that plane was urgently required in the Angolan war, that we also know, because the Russians had entered the fray with the most sophisticated aircraft that we could not resist. So it was a panic stations to get whatever was needed in terms of rocketry or whatever. And it seems that this was what made them go in for this whole smuggling operation, getting the stuff from illicitly, quote-unquote, from an American source in the Pacific, put on a passenger plane so that it didn't look like military cargo, persuading your crews. We know the pilot was most reluctant, had previously objected to taking these materials on his flights. Obviously, a pilot's not only concerned for his own safety, but for his passengers. Now, I think the horror at the time, not only exposing your allies and exposing your military strategies or whatnot, but the fact that you had a government that was prepared to sacrifice the lives of 200 of its innocent civilian citizens in the cause of this, I think, you know, it was too horrendous to imagine.
Martin Veltz, thank you for that contribution. Too horrendous to imagine, indeed. And if with permission, I'm going to steal 5 minutes after the news to wrap up the conversation with David about that horror. Martin, calling in there, the editor of Newsweek, but of course a reporter who worked on the story at the time of the crash. Wrapping up the conversation around the crash of the Helderberg today, 30 years ago. David, I mean, we've just heard that extraordinary description from Martin Veltz about his early reporting work and the web of lies and smoke screens that were pulled across this story. Just to put it on the record emphatically, it's your belief that there was an illegal cargo on board that plane. What do you think it was?
They were carrying ammonium perchlorate or something very close to ammonium perchlorate. It was a fully made-up rocket fuel because we had the ability to make ammonium perchlorate, but not in the fully developed phase to use as a rocket fuel. We had problems in Angola with the Air Force there. Lose the air battle, lose the ground battle. Mm. And there was panic, and that's why they brought it out. It was given to us probably by America because there was a lot of underhand dealing. We were fighting a proxy war for America on the frontline states, keeping communism out of Africa for America and Britain. Maggie Thatcher was just as keen to help us under the table. And what happened was that got on board the aircraft. ACE complained there was a prior fire. They had a fire shortly after takeoff, within 3 hours of takeoff. We can prove that without a shadow of doubt. That fire would normally require the plane to be landed by ACE. He was refused permission. That tape went missing. It never went missing. Gert van der Veer arranged for it to be taken out of the tape rack, and it's gone AWOL, as it were. So we know that there was skullduggery there. We know what was on the tape because four people have given affidavits to me who overheard what was on the tape. So all in all, there's been a massive cover-up which has been aided and abetted by the bunch of criminals that govern us now, and we need to get to the truth. It's a very black spot in the history of South Africa, the willful murder of 177 people aboard that flight. And we need to get to the truth. It's time, like the inquest into Timol, that these things get reopened and that we stop telling lies, because sooner or later, those lies will come out.
And David, do you believe that enough evidence is being gathered that we will get an inquiry reopened?
Well, there's enough evidence, but there's no political will to do that. There's more than enough evidence. In fact, at the TRC inquiry, it was recommended by the commissioner at the time that the inquiry be reopened, and the ANC government simply ignored his recommendation.
David, thank you for being with us today and sharing your insights. Thank you to Martin Veltz, who called in as well, editor of Newsweek. You've been listening to David Klatzer, forensic investigator, who has been looking into this case for all of the 30 years past. I've just got two calls I'd like to take before we must move on. And one of those is from Lindsay, who has called in from the CBD. Lindsay, I believe you too lost your father on that flight. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Pippa. I'm the youngest of six children, and I was 8 months old when my dad died.
I'm so sorry. I mean, to say it must have had a profound impact on your life is the understatement of the century, Lindsay. Yeah. But can you give us a sense of what it has meant to your family, particularly to not know for sure what happened?
I think, you know, it's something that you just sort of learn to deal with. You always wish and you hope that something will come of it, but you also have to learn to live life. Knowing that at the end of the day, certain truths have always been hidden. And you get on with life. My mother was about 34 years old, left with six kids. And it is what it is, you know, and I just take, she's my hero. Yeah,
Lindsay, I mean, if they were to succeed in getting the inquiry reopened, is that a process you would support? Or, as having said, you have to learn to move on with life, have you had to move on sort of mentally as well? Or would you like the opportunity to have this reopened?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we've always followed the case, myself personally, from a distance, not wanting to get too involved because it is an emotional thing. But obviously, the truth at the end of the day would be just a huge relief. And just, I know my dad had a twin brother who's never been able to move on since the Helderberg. just fighting to know the truth behind the whole thing.
Lindsay Wills, thank you. Our thoughts very much with you and your family today on this anniversary. Lindsay having lost her father in the crash of the Helderberg, and giving you a sense there of the breadth of the devastation. I mean, Peter in that interview yesterday described being part of a family that he would rather not have been part of, a family of survivors and a family of those left behind that spans the entire world, who all want the truth. John has given us a call from Constantia. John, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi.
What's your connection with the story?
Well, something that tweaked my interest. I was flying once from Mauritius to Hong Kong, and in the middle of the night, they suddenly said there's a fire on board, and we're having to land on the island of Diego Garcia, which is an American Navy base. And this tweaked my interest, because you mentioned now about picking up cargoes of unlisted stuff. But I'd always thought that, because when we landed there, we had to spend the night at the Navy base before the plane could take off again. And they said the stuff malfunctioned, which records there's a fire on board, and so I thought one of two things might have happened. When the actual Helderberg caught light, they'd had previous problems with these fire alarm systems, and probably just ignored it to start with. But now I've heard the other thing about the possibility of picking up some kind of illicit cargo at an American Navy base, which I just found quite interesting for me personally.
Interesting reflection. John, thank you. David, just to confirm, John has said echoes what you said standard procedure should have been if there was a fire on board an aircraft.
Correct. And they were within easy landing distance of Diego Garcia, by the way.
Okay. We have to wrap the conversation there. Some very interesting comments from all of our guests today. And just to close, I'd like to share with you one final comment from Peter Otson about his ongoing quest to get the story reopened and his request for anybody who knows anything further to come forward.
While it might be substantially far away in terms of a timeline, there are many people out there who know a great deal about what happened. And it's now more than ever vitally important for those people to stand up and be counted, because true evil prevailed 30 years ago to the day, and it's time for that to come to an end. So if there are those people who know what's going on, you know, who've got information, they are more than welcome to accelerate the process of finding out the truth. They can contact me. I've got an email address. It's helderbergcrash@gmail.com. And the sooner we get that information, the sooner we can start getting a proper commission of inquiry going.
I hope that may indeed come to pass. Peter Otson, thank you for your contribution all the way from Australia. David Klatzoff, great to have you with us today as well.